MechCast, Tuesday, January 8th, 2013. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's Tom for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. We are in a new year now. Welcome to 2013. This is actually the ninth year of me doing the MechCast, and I'm so happy to be able to continue to bring you the show. Love this community, love talking about Apple and Mac products, and we're going to do more of that this year as well as in this episode. So we'll dive right into all of the news and some hints and tips and tricks here in a minute. But before we get into that, I want to welcome a new sponsor to the MechCast, and that is Squarespace. I'm so happy to have them on board. I love Squarespace. If you don't know what Squarespace is, it's basically everything that you need to build an exceptional website. So, okay, let's say, for example, you have an idea for that great new app, or maybe a podcast you want to start, or a Kickstarter product that you want to promote, or maybe you're just starting a family blog. Whatever it is, Squarespace can help you out. The trouble typically you'll have when you want to start a website is that there's a lot of hassle, right? You got to get a domain, you got to find hosting, you got to design the thing, you got to code it if you can, or you have to hire somebody to do that for you. You have to upload the whole thing. It's a bunch of hassle, right? It isn't, though, with Squarespace. You can get all of that stuff done literally in minutes. Plus, they have 24-hour customer support to back you up, and all you have to do literally is sign up. Once you have an account, you go in there, they've got these great tools, you can drag and drop, do the whole thing. They've got templates already built out with great designs that you can fully customize, and then once you have it up and running, they make it really easy to maintain your site. No coding required. And if you're like me and you do code, though, what I really appreciate is that they have advanced tools. You can go in there and you can customize everything. So you can go in, you can put in your own HTML, you can put in your own CSS, whatever you want. You can build the site that you're looking for. And they have, if you have a site with content already, you can bring all that stuff in. You can import it, pull it in, and once everything's up and running, they have social media tools. It's all integrated, so you can get out there, you can send messages to your followers, you can promote your stuff and keep your site up to date. All of this functionality and stuff, you'd think it would be expensive, but it really isn't. They have great unlimited plans that are a really good value. They give you a ton of features, unlimited pages, galleries and blogs, unlimited storage, tons of bandwidth. You can have contributors. So if you're working with other people, all of that at a low monthly cost. And if you sign up for a 1 year or 2 year plan, you save even more. Does it sound too easy? It really is. Plus, you can try it all for free. No credit card required. Truly free. Just go to squarespace.com/MechCast to sign up, and that'll get you up and running. You can try everything out fully featured, and then when you're ready to make the purchase, you're ready to subscribe, guess what? You get an additional 10% off just for being a MechCast listener. So when you're signing up for your plan, just click the Enter an Offer Code button below the pricing at checkout, and then enter the offer code MechCast1. So that's go to squarespace.com/MechCast. When you're making your purchase, offer code MACCAST1, and you're going to love it. I know you are. I just built a site, literally built a site today. I'm going to tell you about it at the end of the show using Squarespace. So great service. So happy to have them on board, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MechCast. So let's get into some of the latest Mac news. It looks like the new iMacs, or new Macs rather, are going to be getting a bit faster in the Wi-Fi department. This report comes from the Next Web. They're saying that the next round of Apple's computers should have Wi-Fi support for the 802.11ac spec, the latest flavor of 802.11 Wi-Fi networking. They say Apple has finally struck a deal with their Wi-Fi chip supplier Broadcom to bring the technology to future Macs. This is also known as 5G Wi-Fi, I guess the fifth generation of the Wi-Fi specification. The new spec offers the benefits you'd expect over 802.11g and all the prior specifications, faster throughput, higher capacity, wider coverage range, improved power efficiency. Probably the one that I'm most excited about is the wider coverage, the basically extended range of the wireless signal. That's something I've struggled with in my own house, had to run wires, had to come up with other solutions. I'm actually using the power line adapters, which are great, but being able to extend the range of the Wi-Fi, have it go out further and better signal quality is going to be a welcome upgrade. So looking forward to getting those devices in the future. There's some further supporting rumors that Apple may also be updating the new products because they posted some job postings recently that showed up, and they're looking for experienced gigabit Wi-Fi engineers. So they're definitely investing in some staff. And we're hearing rumors that the components are all set to go from Broadcom. So we should be seeing that in the next lineup of Macs, future Macs that are coming out. As far as the speed of 802.11ac, it promises a maximum throughput of 450 megabits per second. That's on a single antenna configuration. Currently, 802.11n routers, most of them are having three antenna configurations. So that's how they sort of boost up the speed. So in theory, an 802.11ac router with three antenna could give you a theoretical maximum throughput of about 1.3 gigabits per second. So that's plenty fast for doing most applications. And the best news is because the chips are more power efficient, they're going to be suitable for smartphones and tablets as well. So we could be getting faster iPads and faster iPhones and connected devices on 802.11ac as well in the future. Right now, the rumors are mainly focused on the Macs. And if Apple does release 802.11ac compatible Macs, I would imagine that they're going to update their routers. You're going to have compatible routers to get the fastest speeds. So I assume Apple will give us updated airport base stations around the same time they start releasing those Macs. And even if they don't, the good news is, yes, it's backward compatible with 802.11n, but of course you're going to be running at the lower speeds until you can update all of your equipment to the faster specification. But the good news is it's coming. I know we've hardly started the new year, and already analysts are speculating on what Apple will do, not this quarter, but next summer. There's a lot of speculation and a rumor going on based on some of the prep work Apple has been doing about what the next iPhone is going to look like. They're running through prototypes and designs. They're testing chips and new components. They're lining up suppliers already. They're going to have to start going into production at the end of the quarter. Usually around the end of the first quarter, they'll start doing production for the summer. So that's why we're starting to get these rumors and speculations about next generation iPhones. They're calling it the iPhone 5S, and at least two analysts, Jefferies' Peter Misick and Brian White from Topeka Capital Markets, seem to be echoing the same kind of intel about what the next generation iPhone is going to look like. They say that Apple is going to release an iPhone 5S in the May-June timeframe, and that it's going to be in different colors like the iPods are now. So we're going to be getting additional colors beyond just the black and white, according to analyst speculation. They also believe that Apple will offer multiple screen sizes, at least a larger screen model to compete with the ever-growing demand for the Android megaphones, large, some people call them phablets or large phones, something in the 5-inch plus range. Although it sounds like from the rumors I've been hearing, the iPhone might be just slightly smaller, something like 4.8 inches. I had a good conversation with Ken Ray on the last MacCast members episode about my feelings on this. I've been adamantly against Apple doing a larger screen iPhone, but I'm starting to come around just based on consumer demand and where the market seems to be moving. I'm not entirely sold yet, so don't think I've gone crazy or anything. I hate the idea of a larger screen phone, but I can see the possibility of why Apple might be considering it. And that's really the point, right? At this point, a lot of these rumors are coming out based on prototype designs. And of course, Apple's thinking about all kinds of different form factors, including smaller screens. We're also hearing a lot of rumors that Apple is looking to do a smaller, maybe even lower cost device for emerging markets. And that makes a lot of sense. China is a big potential market for Apple. They do a lot of sales already in China on their high-end phones. But if they could get a lower price device in some of those markets, that might help increase their market share and bottom line, and something beyond just what they've done in the past where they take the last year model and make it a little bit cheaper. I think we're hearing more rumors that Apple might get more serious about the lower end of the scale. And that's something that I believe could happen now that the iPhone has become a pretty mature phone. And there's also a lot of competition in the marketplace. Apple tends to innovate, come out with a high-end product, service that market until sales start to die down a little bit. If you remember, they did this with the iPods, right? They just had the iPods for a long time. And then as more and more competitors came on board, prices came down, technology became viable, they started expanding out that product line and hitting more areas of the market. So this is nothing new for Apple. I don't think it's the kind of thing some people are speculating and alleging that Apple is changing now that Steve Jobs is gone. Actually, Ken Ray and I talked about that a little bit too. And I can see where that may be happening, and we want to keep an eye on it, but I'm not entirely sold that that's what's going on, that Apple is just chasing Android. But we do have Tim Cook in place. He's a different CEO than Jobs, and we'll have to see how Apple responds and reacts. But I think a lot of it just has to do with timing. So back on what we're going to hear with the iPhone 5, rumored specs are that there's going to be an improved camera. We're hearing near-field communication again, so that's the use your phone to pay, you know, by waving over a little sensor. I am still not convinced on that one. I don't know why it keeps coming back. I guess because some of the Android devices and other phones are out there supporting that technology. I know that NFC technologies are in wider use, I think, outside the U.S., but I still don't think it's a huge market. And plus, I still think with Apple's Easy Pay system that they're using with their own app and in the Apple stores, Apple could build a whole payment system tied to your iTunes account, and I think that would be genius, and it's already built into the phones. You can use the camera, so I just don't see Apple getting into the NFC business, but that rumor is there. Next generation iPhone 5S will have NFC, according to analysts, and I guess this is probably not a big surprise to anybody. There's going to be an improved processor, an A7 with better battery life, and that's something that every generation of phone, Apple's going to be targeting better processor, better battery life, and then they'll roll that out across their mobile products. We've seen that historically, and I think that trend is going to continue. And then just ahead of CES, which opened up this week, Corning announced that it has its next generation Gorilla Glass ready to go. They claim the third generation of the glass is 3 times more scratch resistant than the Gorilla Glass 2. And it uses something they call native damage resistance technology. They don't really explain that what that is, but they also claim that when your device does get scratches with Gorilla Glass 3, that you are 40% less likely to see them. So I thought, you know, that begs to question. If an iPhone's glass gets scratched in the woods and you can't really see it, is it really scratched? Don't know, but better glass, and we can be pretty sure that'll find its way into the next generation iOS devices, including the iPhone 5S, if that ends up being what it's called, because Apple does use Corning Gorilla Glass as the glass technology in the iPhone, and that doesn't look to be changing anytime soon. So that should all be arriving sometime this summer. We got a little bit of a wait on that one, and I'm sure we're going to be hearing a lot more about next generation iPhone technology over the next 6 months. And while I'm fairly certain that the next generation iPhone is going to feature a new processor, one big change that is likely to happen this year is that processor might not be manufactured by Samsung. The writing for this has been on the wall for a while, but it looks like that exodus might be starting this year. Taiwan Commercial Times is reporting that Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, TSMC, is about to start trial production on Apple's A6 chip as early as this quarter. If you remember, there was a rumor, I think last time that we talked about, or a couple episodes ago, that Apple and TSMC may be building a $10 billion chip fabrication plant in the U.S., possible locations were rumored to be New York or Oregon. It wasn't 100% certain who Apple's chip partner would be in that facility, but TSMC was certainly on that card. And now we're hearing these rumors that Apple is in trial production of their ASICs processor with TSMC, so it seems a likely choice. Apple has also reportedly been cutting Samsung out of their display business. I told you about the rumors that of a move to Sharp IGZO panels, especially with Sharp now licensing that technology to Intelux and possibly to AU Optronics, two of those companies being Apple suppliers. Also, it's been rumored for a while that Apple was trying to move to that IGZO technology, but yields were a big issue. They needed enough panels to be able to be produced, and so Sharp bringing on additional potential suppliers for Apple could help speed things along in that department. The China Times is also now saying that Apple is evaluating touch-on-display technology from Intelux as a possible replacement to their in-cell technology that they recently moved to. That was where they finally fused the touch and LCD layers of their panels to make them more responsive. I guess according to some sources, Apple has been having some interference issues with the in-cell technology and might be looking for something different. Touch-on-display technology apparently offers better optical performance and up to 10-point multi-touch sensitivity for the display in a very thin 0.5 millimeter panel. So Apple always looking to make things thinner. Seems like it would be a viable technology. Of course, yields are always going to be a concern for Apple. So they're going to be, I'm sure, a lot of rumors about Apple testing out new displays, looking at the IGZO and the TOD technologies, and we'll have to see where they end up on that one. But if Apple does want Samsung out of its processor business, they have about a year to get these new suppliers on board and in line for production. Apple reportedly has contracted with Samsung until 2014, for their processor fabrication, and that gives them till the end of the year to line up new suppliers before they have to kind of renegotiate and sign new contracts with Samsung if they're going to keep them on board building AX chips. And I think Apple has no desire to continue that contract. So I think we're going to see them working very hard with companies like TSMC, potentially other chip manufacturers, to move that production away from Samsung. Apple will be delivering its first fiscal quarter 2013 earnings on January 23rd in just a couple weeks, but there are already estimates that show the reports could be very positive once again for Apple. An analyst from Evercore Partners thinks that Apple may announce sales of over 50 million iPhones for the quarter. That would represent a 35% year-over-year increase and be up 86% from the prior quarter. He also sees iPad sales up 56% year over year with a prediction of 24 million units sold, with almost half of those sales going to Apple's new iPad mini, which he thinks sold about 10 million units. On the Mac side, the predictions aren't quite as positive. Apple may actually see a slight year over year slide in Mac sales, with roughly 5 million Macs being sold. That would represent a decline of about 3% year over year. And according to numbers from NPD Group, they say the MacBook Pro line itself might see about a 6% year over year sales decline. So Apple finally being hit by declining PC sales. They had sort of been skating along, escaping that, actually bucking the trend of the industry in general, but it sounds like this quarter maybe that has caught up with them. The Evercore analyst also believes that part of the reason for the slip might be the supply constraints of the new iMacs, lowering the sales numbers for the quarter. As a matter of fact, 27-inch iMacs are now showing ship times of about 3 to 4 weeks, so orders being put in right now aren't going to be shipping till well into February. In terms of market share and usage, though, Apple is still holding its own on the mobile front. The latest Comscore numbers showed that in the U.S., iPhone usage was about 35% of all smartphone use and 18.5% of all mobile phone use as of November 2012. Samsung is still the number one most used mobile phone in the U.S. with about 26.9% of the share, followed by Apple, and then LG was in third place with about 17.5%. The real good news for Apple in those numbers was they actually saw growth in their usage, up about 1.4% for all mobile phones, and that was likely spurred on by the quick rollout and popularity of the iPhone 5. Still on the OS front, though, Android leads smartphone usage in the U.S. with about 53.7% of the market. So they still lead overall market share by quite a large margin, but Apple was seeing a trend upward, at least over the last couple months. And on the sales side, that turned out to be really good news for Apple, at least in the short term. For a 12-week period ending on November 25th, 2012, Kantar World Panel crunched the U.S. sales numbers and found that the iPhone actually jumped to a 53.3% sales share, beating out Android devices for that period, which saw an actual 10.9% decline, dropping to a sales share of about 41%. And there was more good news in the Kantar report, and that was that 27% of customers buying an iPhone were actually upgrading from another OS, 40% were first-time smartphone purchasers, and just 35% were upgrading from previous iPhones. So not only was Apple gaining share, but they were picking up new customers in the process. And if you're like me and you're looking at these numbers and it all starts to get jumbled and a little bit confusing and you're going, hey, wait a minute, why are the Kantar numbers seeming much more positive in terms of Apple gaining share against Android versus the Comscore numbers? And I have to tell you, it's all just about timing and the data set. Remember that Kantar is looking at recent sales numbers right after the release of the iPhone 5. So Apple's picking up steam, popularity of the iPhone 5 growing. Also, Apple did a very aggressive global rollout of the iPhone 5. That's causing their sales numbers to shift upward. Comscore, on the other hand, is looking at overall usage numbers. It's for a similar period, but it includes all devices that are in the market at the time. So that's prior phones, whereas the Kantar numbers are really just looking at the new sales numbers moving forward. So the good news for Apple in both of these reports is that they saw trends upward in both accounts. So end of the year numbers for the iPhone looking very positive. On the tablet side of the house, though, looks like Apple lost a little ground to Android, at least in the post-holiday numbers when it comes to web usage. And Android gained, it looks like, at the expense of the iPad, at least according to Chitika. They crunched their web usage data for the post-holiday season, the few weeks following Christmas, and they found that web usage on Android devices was up, being spurred on and led by the Kindle Fire, which jumped its usage share more than 4%, moving up to 7.5% of all tablet traffic. The Samsung Galaxy tablet also saw gains, coming in at about 4.39%. Now, the iPad still has a whopping commanding lead of all tablet web usage, according to Chitika, 78.86% market share, but that did represent a 7.1% drop from pre-holiday usage. So that tends to show that a lot of people picked up new Android tablets over the holidays and are starting to use them. And that was, again, a trend that Apple's been able to buck so far, but it looks like the tides are changing. So it's going to be interesting to see how Apple responds in 2013. I think at this point, they have such a lead, they don't have to really worry, but I expect that this is a sort of report that we're going to hear throughout, that Android is going to continue to gain in the tablet space. And that's just a factor of there's more devices out there. It's the same kind of trend we saw when Android phones started hitting the market and moving on the iPhone. And you know my opinion on this stuff. I think for Apple, it's not about share numbers or usage numbers. What they really look at is making the best devices in the world and making money on those devices and services and things like that. And that's a trend for Apple that I don't see changing anytime soon. 2012 also proved to be a very great year for app downloads. On Monday, Apple announced that they had reached their 40 billionth app downloaded. And while that's a very impressive number, something that shocked me even more was that actually half of those 40 billion downloads, 20 billion of them, happened just in 2012 alone. So when you think about how long we've had the app marketplace and how long it took Apple to get to the first 20 billion, several years, and then they hit 20 billion, another 20 billion in just 1 year, that is amazing. So that's just showing that there's a lot of iOS devices out there, and there's still a lot of customers that Apple is bringing on board and selling to. So a great year for tablets and a great year for Apple by that same token. TechCrunch caused a bit of a stir last week when it claimed that Apple was making an attempt to buy out the community-based mapping and navigation company Waze. According to the original report, they said that Apple had supposedly made an offer of about $500 million for the company, but Waze was holding out for more. They wanted $750 million. TechCrunch and others then later reported that there never was any buyout talks. As a matter of fact, CNET went as far as calling the rumors completely fabricated. Then later, NextWeb claimed that Apple and Waze did actually talk about a potential buyout, but ultimately that Waze turned Apple down. What actually happened, only Apple and Waze will probably ever know, but Apple does already use some of Waze data in its iOS 6 maps. It does make perfect sense that Apple would express an interest in a company like Waze, especially in light of their efforts to improve their mapping system after the bad press they got following its introduction in iOS 6. Waze has some pretty cool technology. They allow users to provide real-time traffic and incident data to update maps, and also they have a system for the community to be able to submit map corrections and updates, making them more regionally accurate, something Apple could benefit from. So at the very least, I think Apple could be wanting to license and integrate more of Waze technology into its own mapping system, even if it doesn't buy out the company. So probably they had talks on both ends of the spectrum, and we'll have to wait and see if anything moves forward. But it sounds like, at least for now, there's not a buyout happening. I told you on the last episode about Apple's New Year's Day bug with its Do Not Disturb feature in iOS 6. It stopped working, and a lot of people were wondering what's going on. Suddenly, it just wouldn't come out of Do Not Disturb mode if you were using the scheduling feature. Well, Apple reported in a support article that everything would be fixed and working properly again after Monday, January 7th. So, as far as I know, my devices seem to be working normally. There's a support article up on Apple's website noting the issue and giving out the January 7th date. What was really weird about this, though, was that Apple didn't mention why it was broken, and apparently they didn't have to do anything to fix it other than to wait a week. So, very odd bug indeed. No firmware patch, no update, nothing you have to run. It should just magically be working again. And then finally, at CES this week, Intel revealed details about its fourth-generation mobile processors, codenamed Haswell. The chips are based on the same 22-nanometer designs that power the Ivy Bridge processors found in the most recent iMacs and Mac Minis. The main focus of Haswell seems to be power efficiency, which Intel claims is the most significant improvement in mobile power efficiencies in the company's history. The Haswell also brings improvements in the integrated Intel HD graphics. It's likely we'll see Apple use the new processors the next time they update their MacBook and MacBook Pro lines, although Intel's vice president of the PC group, Kirk Skoudjian, did throw a curveball to some ultra PC makers who might be planning on using the new chips. Those systems are going to be required to have touch-enabled screens. Now, it's highly unlikely that Apple's MacBook Air line would be required to comply with the restriction because the Ultrabook designation seems to be applicable only to Windows-based PCs. I also don't think that Apple would ever agree to let a supplier dictate the design or functionality of its products, so I think it's safe to assume that Apple is excluded from that requirement. And even if Intel went crazy and did try to force this requirement on Apple, I think it's been rumored for a while now that Apple has considered moving to its own custom processor designs for future Macs, and many believe that the MacBook Air would be the product that they started with. So if Intel was trying to strong-arm Apple, they could use the threat of taking their processor business away from Intel as leverage, but I don't even think Intel would try something that ridiculous. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to thank another one of our show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. Hey, if you're hoping to pick up a new iPhone, iPod, iPad, maybe even a new Mac, before you get your new one, make sure you sell your used device on Gazelle. You can get cash that you can use for your upgrade. Gazelle is great because they make it so simple and straightforward and secure to get cash for your old stuff. All you have to do is go to gazelle.com, tell them a little bit about the condition, They'll even buy broken iPhones and iPads, give you cash for those. And after just providing a few bits of information, they will give you an upfront, risk-free offer that's locked in for 30 days. And Gazelle will send you a box so you can send in your item. And in some cases, they'll even pay the shipping. So couldn't be simpler. And once the item's received, they'll process it quickly and you can get paid fast by check or by PayPal. So you can do all of that, send in your device under your 30-day lock-in and get the cash you need for your new item. So what's your iPhone, your iPad worth? Just take a minute, go to gazelle.com and find out. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. I mentioned earlier that Apple is selling more apps than ever, 20 billion over the last year. And while that's an amazing number, I wanted to comment on something that I've been thinking about lately. And actually, some numbers that came out from a website called Apple Sliced got me thinking about even more. And it's a big concern that I have for developers and their ability to sustain companies, make a living off of the current app ecosystem. The report that came out from a site called Apple Sliced, which is an app store pricing tracker site, they did some crunching of their end-of-the-year numbers and found that 32.7% of iOS apps lowered their price at some point in 2012. That doesn't mean that they were selling their apps permanently for a lower price, but at some point, 32.7% of developers lowered the price of their apps, probably for some promotional reason to try and drum up sales. And that is the thing that brings up this concern in my mind, and that is that for all of the great benefits that apps in the App Store bring us as consumers, still several years into this ecosystem, there continues to be these big issues and challenges that developers have with getting noticed on their apps, but also more importantly, with app prices. In my mind, low App Store prices make it very hard for anybody but maybe single indie developers to make long-term sustainable profits and really run a business. And I would imagine even for some of the indie developers, it's quite challenging. Add to that all of the shovelware, sort of garbage stuff that is in the App Store, and just getting through that muck and the noise is extremely, extremely challenging. And then you throw on top of that, if you spent time and effort and a lot of money building a really quality app and not being able to get it to stand out, or it just gets lost in the shuffle of the cheap stuff, that is incredibly annoying. It also makes it very hard, I think, for developers to charge premium prices for their quality software because consumers end up seeing it as gouging. And I see even reviewers doing this where there'll be a really great app. I saw it today. I forget which site had it, but there was a review of an app, actually one that was developed by a friend of the show, Clayton Morris, who many of you know, and he's been on, and you've probably heard me interview him. He created this really great app. He's into speed reading, I guess. I didn't even know, but he built this app, and it's called ReadQuick, and it essentially trains you how to become a faster reader, and it's really cool. It integrates with Pocket and Instapaper, and you throw your articles that you want to read, your feeds into it, and then you pull up the app and you can sort of set a speed and a pace, and it will train you to read quicker, to learn essentially what it amounts to speed reading. And it's a very useful app, and I think the price on it is like $2.99. So very affordable, but there was this glowing review, and they said the only problem is that it's too expensive. And I'm thinking, how can $3 less than the price of a cup of coffee be too expensive? But that's sort of the mentality that the app stores have pushed us into. And for a developer, only making $3 off your app, something that has a lot more value in it, you know, you spend time and money and effort developing it, hiring programmers, hiring designers, hiring people to market it for you, that's not cheap. And when you have your consumers hemming and hawing over $3, it's just got to be completely frustrating. And, you know, I know this is how free markets should work, and I agree with that 100%, that sort of the marketplace sets the price. But here's my concern. If we force quality out by insisting that this stuff be dirt cheap, then where we're going to end up is with only mediocre options at best to choose from. And at worst, it's just going to be a bunch of cheap garbage. And so that concerns me a lot. Another thing that concerns me is that we still haven't given developers a real trial system to work with. So that makes it a lot harder for the developers to give apps to people so that they can at least show, look it, this app is so much better than that other cheap one. There's a lot of value in here, and this is why I'm charging what I'm charging for it. What happens today is because they can't give you a free trial version, like a 30-day free trial, a lot of consumers just go off of price. And that is another thing that just makes it very hard to succeed. That, along with the lack of any sustainable kind of revenue and rewards for loyal customers in the form of paid upgrades, so that I can get a new version of the app, pay the developer for all the efforts that went into that new version, and get a discounted price because I'm already a customer. What has happened is the App Store ecosystem has forced developers to use cheaper upgrade pricing when they launch a new app, and that then becomes available for everybody, new customers as well as existing customers. They either have to do that, or in my mind, what's worse, and I don't even mind that app developers do this, I totally understand why, but they have to release an entirely new version of the application, abandoning the old one, essentially creating a new app in the App Store, even though it's the same application. And I think a big example of this is 1Password. They just came out with their new 4.0 version, and they threw it out at a discounted price, but they had to release a whole new version of the application. It's a separate thing that you buy and download, and that just creates a confusing experience for the consumer. And the whole point of the App Store is it's supposed to be a simple buying and upgrade experience. So, you know, I had fears about this stuff a long time ago, that, you know, that these kinds of problems were going to be persistent in the ecosystem. And I had faith that Apple would address a lot of these issues. And here we are many, many years into it, and still they haven't done anything about that. So I'm hoping that's something that they will look into and work on in the coming year. The other even bigger concern that I had was that some of these flaws and some of these issues with the ecosystem would spill over onto the Mac platform. And with Mountain Lion and the Mac App Store, we're seeing all of the same kinds of bad things happening, where there's a flood of software in the market, prices are being driven down. And if we don't start talking about this stuff seriously and we don't start thinking about it, we're going to find that a lot of our favorite high-quality developers, especially the ones that have a staff, they have several employees, several programmers, marketing people, things like that, they're going to have a very hard time sustaining their businesses. So we as consumers are going to have to step up to the plate to a certain degree, start demanding better quality software, start paying higher prices, and they're not even high prices. That's what's so frustrating to me, is the fact that I have to pay $10, $15 for an app that is quality software that is very affordable. Even $30, $40, $50, $100, considering some applications. Remember, we used to pay hundreds of dollars for many applications, and there are now apps in that $30 to $40 price range that blow away the quality of those apps that we used to pay hundreds of dollars for. So prices have come down, but if we continue to drive them into the dirt, we're going to find ourselves left with not a lot of choices, and definitely not good choices in the future. So I don't know. That's how I'm feeling, and that's sort of what this report brought up in my mind. If you agree with me, totally disagree with me, give me some feedback. Let me know what you're thinking on this. But, you know, I think both developers and us as consumers need to sort of step up the plate step up to the plate and change this trend, because Apple certainly isn't doing it. If you look at their own applications, I mean, the fact that the iWork applications are $10 to $15, and those are awesome applications, shows where they want to push the pricing to. But for anybody except for very small indie developers or large corporations like Apple who can afford to take a loss, that's really not a sustainable pricing system. Just think about it. I mean, think about that for a second if you're trying to run your business. And, you know, you're not going to make it up in volume because there is so much choice out there now. It's just really hard to compete. Again, there are a few exceptions to this, but I'm talking about a broader, larger portion of the market and a larger percentage of the developers who are out there. So I don't know. That was just on my mind this week, and I wanted to share it. So sorry if I ranted a little bit there. You know that I talk about backup on this show a lot, and I get questions about backup quite frequently, but Hank emailed me this week and asked a question that I hadn't been asked before, and I thought it was a great one, and I wanted to sort of address it a little bit on the show. He said, you know, most of my important files on my Mac are my music and photos and movie files, and I use services like iCloud and iTunes Match and Dropbox. And so I think what he's thinking is, in a way, those things are up in the cloud, so he has a sort of offsite backup for those. But he wanted to know if, you know, is that enough, and can we sort of talk about some of the differences, and why would you need to back up those files in addition to having them on those cloud services? And I think, Hank, the way to address that is first by saying, you know, none of those technologies in and of themselves are necessarily what most people would consider a traditional quote-unquote backup system. Yes, they are in the cloud. They're cloud-based services, and so technically there's copies up there on a server somewhere, if you put them there, of course. But and so you could argue that, yeah, they're backed up in a sense. And even further, you could take it a step further and say, you know, because they're in these large data centers, either at Dropbox or Apple, those companies have additional redundant backups of that data on their own systems. The problem there is that it's unlikely that you'll have access to them. Those are really just for their own disaster recovery purposes. So we really can't count those as additional backups. You're not going to be able to get at them if suddenly your hard drive went bad and you lost everything. You know, you'll be able to go back to maybe the cloud service and sync it back down, but you're not going to have direct access to those secondary copies that they might make at the data center. So I think the best way to approach this is to kind of look at each service and how it works and compare that a little bit to other more traditional forms of backup. So starting with iCloud, and most specifically documents in the cloud, what happens there is it's put up into the cloud via the integration with OS X, specifically OS X Mountain Lion, and any applications that support it. And in Mountain Lion, the most obvious of these applications where you're going to see documents in the cloud are Apple's apps, specifically the iWork applications or something like TextEdit. You can now, in the open dialog box, access and add files and documents to your documents in the cloud. And you can put them in the cloud, you can take them out of the cloud, put them on your Mac, move them. You know, we've talked about how you do that in past shows. But the way iCloud works is you put those copies up onto Apple's storage, in the cloud storage, and you also actually have copies of those stored locally on your Mac. So if you go into your home folder, into the library folder, there's a mobile documents folder, and anything you put into iCloud is actually stored there, and it's synced up to the cloud, up to documents in the cloud and iCloud in the background. So technically you have a local copy, you have the copy that's up in the cloud, but those aren't easily accessible at the Finder level. So it really just feels to most users like I've got documents in the cloud and that's it. And so really in my mind, that just counts as one copy. And that's when you just have one copy, that's not really a backup. Yes, you technically have the local copy, but you're going to have a hard time finding that and accessing that if you need to do disaster recovery. So I guess in a lot of ways, a lot of the things that we're going to talk about, and the main reason why I don't count these as backup systems, is more about the hassles in terms of what happens when you need to do disaster recovery. So let's talk a little bit about iTunes Match. For those who don't know, iTunes Match is a service that you can sign up for through Apple. It's $25 US a year. And once you subscribe to the service, what it does is it goes through and it scans through your iTunes library, and any non-iTunes purchased music files that it finds, it will try and match with tracks that are in the iTunes catalog, all of the songs that Apple sells via iTunes. And if it does find a match, then it's made available and you can re-download that or stream that track directly from iTunes in the cloud to any of your devices or Macs that are connected to it. Any music that it finds that is not in Apple's iTunes catalog, iTunes Store catalog, and that you have encoded in your iTunes library at 64 kilobits per second or better, that gets uploaded into iTunes in the cloud and is also made available through the service. And then anything else is not uploaded at all and is not in the iTunes Match service. So that portion of iTunes Match isn't even put into the cloud. So that definitely doesn't count as a backup. But anything that you purchased from iTunes, that is also available for download. But you know, that's just like the iTunes in the cloud service. Apple maintains a record of what you've purchased, and you've always had the ability, or since they announced iTunes in the cloud, rather, had the ability to re-download those tracks. And I think that's for most, if not all, music on the iTunes store. Don't quote me on that one. The other thing is that movies and TV shows that you purchased through iTunes in many cases can also now be re-downloaded from the iTunes service. So Apple has a copy of those. And that's actually one of the reasons why I started purchasing movies finally through iTunes, because I never wanted to have to maintain copies of those. But that's purchased content, and I'm trusting and assuming that Apple is always going to have that available for me and that Apple's not going anywhere anytime soon. But, you know, should Apple go out of business, I'm not going to have access to that stuff if I haven't made additional backup copies or archives someplace else. So depending on how your music library is, iTunes Match may work as a sort of pseudo backup system, but there's a lot of little bits and pieces that might get missed, specifically any odd out there tracks, stuff that's not encoded at 64 kilobits per second, that's not getting backed up. Also, if you have your own video files that you ripped into iTunes, your own TV show content, again, remember, this is just music. iTunes Match only covers music and not any video content. So you still need to be able to have backup for that. So it's really not true backup because, once again, too, you don't necessarily have access to all of the source data and the source files. You got to go through iTunes. You can't just mount those files, you know, on a web dav or access them through FTP or get at them through some other way. So that's iTunes Match. Dropbox, this is a cloud-based storage service, and you can sign up for a free account. It gives you 2 gigabytes of storage, and the way it works, for those who don't know, is, in essence, you install the Dropbox software on your Mac, it creates a folder in your home folder, a Dropbox folder, and then any files or folders that you place inside that are automatically uploaded and synced to the cloud up to Dropbox's servers. And they have the app. They have an app for iOS, so you can actually access your files and folders. They also have integration with a lot of mobile applications. So it's really cool because anything that you put in there is automatically synced. So you have a local copy that you can access when you're not connected, and you also have the copy that is up on Dropbox's servers. And only items that are in that Dropbox folder are synced up to the service. So if you're not putting all your files and folders and documents in there, then you're not getting extra copies made, and it's not really getting backed up. You do have that local copy, so that's a good thing. And another benefit of files that are in your Dropbox folder and uploaded to Dropbox is that they're versioned, so you can actually go back and get prior versions of those if you did an accidental, you know, save as and overwrote something like that. So from that standpoint, it's a fairly good service. But once again, I don't necessarily count Dropbox as an extra backup, because anything that I put in my Dropbox folder, I just consider to be one copy, even though there is technically one up there in the cloud. But it really doesn't cover all of the documents and files that are on my system. So, you know, the main thing about all these cloud services is they're just not backup in the traditional sense. I will tell you that I use these services to provide me one more copy of a lot of the files that I already have backed up via other means. And to be sure, using this kind of service and having access to these extra copies in the cloud, it's better than nothing. But I think the problem I have with them is, in essence, you're relying on somebody else for all of your backed up files, and you're relying on someone else for access to that. So if one of the services goes down or goes out of business, you're completely sunk in terms of getting access to those files. So you want to take responsibility and control of your own backup. You still want one or two forms of local backup. I really recommend everybody be using Time Machine. There's no excuse for not at least using Time Machine. And I use Clone Backup, Carbon Copy Cloner, Super Duper. You've heard me talk about all these things before. And then you want some sort of offsite solution. I personally like CrashPlan. They're now a MacCast sponsor, but I've been using them for years. I love the service, but there's also Backblaze and Carbonite, a bunch of other online services that you can set up. And that gives you an additional offsite copy. And with these services, you know, you have an application, you can go in and you can access it. They have iOS applications, and they are just centered around backup, defining files and folders and items that you want backups created from. Cloud-based services, I consider more just like additional file storage or hard drive. So in the same way, I would attach an external USB drive to provide additional place for me to store files, I look at these kinds of services like that. So that's how I think about it. Some people might debate me on that, but that's my two cents. And I hope that helps kind of explain things, Hank. And then finally today, I received an email from Mike. And Mike asked me a question about something that I think I know I've known about for a long time, and you probably have known about for a long time, but I think that a lot of us probably never gave much thought to. And that is the DCIM folder that is on your iPhone or your iPad. And the first thing may be that maybe you don't even know that the DCIM folder exists on your iOS device. And that's because typically it's not visible. And you can actually see it using some third-party applications. And if you're going to use some of these, be careful. Make sure that you back up your data, your iOS data, your iPhone, your iPad, before you start messing around in there. But there's an application from Ecamm called PhoneView. There's also one called iExplorer from MacroPlant. And what these allow you to do is, when you have your iOS device connected to your Mac through its charge sync cable, you can actually go in and you can navigate the folder structure and get access to some of the data and information that is directly on the device. And the DCIM folder in iOS devices is in the VAR mobile media folder. And in case you just don't know what a DCIM folder is, I probably should explain that. If you own a digital camera, you probably have seen a DCIM folder in there too. And essentially what DCIM is it's digital camera images. It's a standard folder name that is part of the Japan Electronics and Information Technologies Industry Association design rules for camera file systems, the DCF specifications. And what these rules do, so that's a lot of, you know, big, long, fancy acronyms for what rules are set by the digital imaging industry, basically, to define the standard directory structure, file naming methods, character sets, file formats, and metadata for digital cameras. And this includes smartphones now, because they have digital cameras built into them. And so in particular, the digital camera image spec, the DCIM folder spec, defines that there is a DCIM folder at the root level of any device that you know, is taking pictures and storing data on some sort of storage media. And, you know, it could be your SD card, or in this case, it could be the storage that's built in to your iPhone. And what happens is if you use a camera application or you insert a card into a camera and that folder doesn't exist, it gets created. And then inside that folder, there's a the specification defines how the subdirectories are named and how the folders are named. So in the case of subdirectories, there is a consistent naming structure. It starts with a three-digit number from 100 to 999, and then that's followed by five alphanumeric characters that can be chosen by the camera maker. And that defines the subdirectory that's set up. And then inside those subdirectories are the individual image files that are taken by the camera. And there's a specific naming structure for that as well. That's defined as four alphanumeric characters, usually something like DSC underscore or IMG underscore. And then that's followed by a four-digit number that is a running incrementing number count, typically for the number of pictures that have been taken on that device. And then that is followed by a file extension, typically .jpg, .jpeg, but it could be something else if you're shooting in camera raw. And it basically represents the files themselves that are in there. So those get named like that. Now, in the case of Apple specifically, they use the DCIM folder. And then inside that, when you're taking pictures, the subfolder naming they use is a three-digit number and then APPLE, Apple. So you'll see a folder like 100 Apple, 101 Apple, 102 Apple as you take more and more pictures all the way up through 999. And then in each subfolder, they use the name IMG underscore and then a four-digit incrementing number, again, following the standard convention to represent the images that you're taking in sequence. And then Apple uses the .jpg extension for photos, .png extension for screenshots that you might take on your iOS device, and .mov extensions for the movie files. I think that third-party applications can add images to the camera roll, and they probably follow the same naming conventions, but I'm not 100% sure. It might be built into the OS-level specifications for actually saving to the camera roll. But inside each one of those subfolders, so I mentioned that in the DCIM folder, Apple will start creating these subfolders starting with 100 Apple, 101 Apple, and moving up. Inside each one of those subfolders, they'll put up to 1,000 image files. And then once there's 1,000 files in the, say, Apple 100 folder, it's going to create an Apple 101 folder and start putting the next batch of 1,000 image files into that. And it keeps going. It keeps building up in sequence. And the actual number sequences appear to be maintained by this plist file, which is actually found in that media folder in a folder called photo data, and then inside that there's a miscellaneous folder and a MISC folder, and then there's a DCIM underscore apple.plist file. And I was poking around in there, I took a look at this, and there's actually a dictionary entry, and then inside that there's DCIM last directory number and DCIM last file number, and that maintains that sort of running count of either the folders or the file numbers as they move up as you take more and more pictures. And I think that's where it's stored, because I actually tried hacking these files to see if I could actually reset or alter the incrementing numbers, and I wasn't able to do it. So maybe Apple has changed that a little bit, but in the past, that's where those had been stored. If somebody knows how that can be sort of tweaked or reset or something like that, let me know. I'd be kind of curious about that. And the reason I was kind of exploring this a little bit was, as I was doing the research, I discovered that there was a bug back in 2009 that was reported by TUAW, where if you took a lot of photos or continued to sort of upgrade your devices and keep restoring from backup and kept letting those numbers increment, eventually you could get to a point where it would exceed 999 for the folder name, or you could have taken 99,999 images, and it would sort of hit that upper limit, and then the camera roll would suddenly appear not to have any more pictures in it. Even though you could be taking pictures, they'd be storing on your device, they just wouldn't show up in the camera roll. It was like it couldn't recognize images beyond that level, or if it reset itself, it couldn't find those images. And the only way to fix it seemed to be to go in with one of these tools, like PhoneView or iExplorer, and actually remove the directory files after you pulled all your images off the device, hopefully. But to actually remove the older folders, say the Apple 100, Apple 102 folders, get those cleaned out, and then once you sort of reset things, then you could get it back to normal. So I don't know if that bug still exists, but you know, if it does, that could be particularly annoying. And the sort of proper way, or the only easy way I know to reset those counters beyond doing some kind of, you know, low-level hacking, would be to actually restore your device and set it up as a new device. If you are going to do that, of course, you're going to want to make sure that you sync all of your photos into something like iPhoto or pull them off with the image capture application, remove them from the phone, and make sure that you back them up. And then you can restore your device, set it up as new, and that's going to reset those counters. I believe if you restore your device and then pull in from backup, this data and these counters will come back. And like I said, I did try using a tool like PhoneView to go in and delete those empty folders and get them off of there, but it just started creating new subfolders and starting the sequence all over again. So I don't know that that would be a particularly long-term fix. If anybody else knows another way to, again, as I was saying earlier, reset things, let us know. Shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. But hopefully that explains a little bit about the DCIM folder structure and what it all means and sort of how it works on your iOS devices, Mike. And again, thanks for the question, because I hadn't really thought about that too much. And with that, I think that's going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software, get more information and details, as well as a free trial over at circusponies.com. Smile, check out Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for the iPhone and the iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch. You can get more information on all of those pieces of software, as well as details at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle is a fast, convenient, easy way to get cash for your old iPhone, iPad. Take a minute and find out what it's worth today. Just head over to gazelle.com. Squarespace, you know, build that great-looking, maintainable website in minutes, not hours or days with Squarespace. You can try it for free. Just head to squarespace.com/mattcast. And when you sign up for the service, make sure you get your additional 10% off by using the offer code MACCAST1. And ShareFile by Citrix. You know, you can take all the hassle out of sharing and sending your business files via old methods like email, attachments, and FTP by using ShareFile. You can try it free for 30 days. Just go to ShareFile.com, click on the radio microphone, and enter my offer code MACCAST. That's ShareFile.com/MACCAST. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Got a couple of things happening over the next month that I want to make you aware of. First and foremost, I am going to be at Macworld iWorld. That is coming up January 31st through February 2nd in San Francisco at Moscone Center. I hope to see many of you there. And if you are attending the show, I'll be doing a live recording from the show floor on Friday, February 1st from 2:30 to 3:30. And what I'm planning to do is interview Macworld attendees and Maccast fans about why they come to the show, the kinds of things that they're seeing there, and what they're doing. If you want to participate in that and you're going to be at Macworld iWorld, email me and I'll try and get you lined up. We'll get you on the air and it should be a lot of fun. And if you need a free expo hall pass, I have those available. I posted details today on the Maccast Facebook page as well as the Google Plus community, or you can just email me and I'll send you a link. And I'll also have a link in the show notes so you can get a free Macworld iWorld expo pass. And then right before Macworld, I think I told you on the last show, Dave Sparks, Mac Sparky, and I were both fans of Disney and specifically Disneyland. And we're trying to organize a Mac Geek Day at Disneyland. So if you'd like to come out on Saturday, January 26th. That's the weekend before Macworld. We'd love to see you. We're just going to hang out. It's going to be really informal. Everybody's going to show up. You have to buy your own ticket. We're not giving away tickets for that one. But if you can get in the park, a bunch of us are going to try and meet up at some point. We'll probably do a photo, maybe have some lunch, and then just go off and enjoy a great day at Disneyland. And we set up a website if you want to get details on what's going on. You can go to DisneyMacGeek.com. Again, I'll have a link to that in the show notes at MacCast.com, and we hope to see you there. That's going to do it for this episode. If you have any feedback for me, you have a question, a comment, you can shoot those to MacCast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's over at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. And be sure to check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And of course, you can also find me on Google Plus, MacCast on Google Plus, and be sure to check out the new MacCast Google Plus community. So, bunch of ways to reach out, participate in the community, and I hope to either see you in person or online, but that'll do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.